Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy any investment based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Hello and welcome to the Sunday Roast. It's Sunday the 23rd of March. I'm Phil Carroll.
I'm Kevin Hornsby.
I am Charles Archer.
What a week it's been. They've got a 3-week cold lingering on. I mean, the weather's been great, but has anyone else had like a cough and just sinuses? And I just feel like, as I said last week, I think it was the week before, like these viruses now are just lasting for ages. You think you're better and then all of a sudden it knocks you back again. What's going on?
I have
on?
That at the moment. Yeah, I'm feeling pretty...
Pretty
yeah,
bad.
I had awful. It before
it's
I came
in the
to
background
England.
Constantly.
Yeah.
I had it before I came to England, and then when I came to England, I got over it, thank goodness. And
hang on.
Now,
look, we were
now
all
I'm
fine.
Feeling quite
Kev came
better.
to England and infected the country.
Yes, I came. I
Your
came
Egyptian germs.
With a Cairo Egyptian germ. That's why. The Cairo cough. That's
The
what you've
Cairo
got.
cough. Oh, God.
But
Another
I
lockdown is
think you
coming.
had it before I came anyway, Phil. But.
I don't know. It just feels like everything's going on. But let's have a look at the news. I mean, it's just dominated every week, isn't it? I think we should just rename it the Trump podcast. I mean, the evolving situation between Trump and Putin, especially regarding the talks about a 30-day ceasefire in Ukraine and how it's playing out with concerns over nuclear power plants, missiles, and energy infrastructure, this week kicked off with a much anticipated phone call between the US President Donald Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin on Tuesday. I think it's somebody said it was a 90-minute conversation. The White House billed it as a step toward ending the war in Ukraine, with Trump pushing for a 30-day ceasefire that Ukraine had already agreed to the week prior. Putin, however, didn't fully buy. Instead, he offered a limited deal, a 30-day pause on attacks targeting energy infrastructure, with both sides have been hammering Russia, knocking out about 80% of Ukraine's energy grid, and Ukraine striking back Russian oil facilities. So what do we make of this sort of not ceasefire that's happening right now?
I don't know. I think it's obviously it's always more complex than what you can put in the podcast. And you don't have all the information either. But I think basically Trump wants peace between Russia and Ukraine to boost the global economy. And he's prepared to do whatever is necessary to make that happen, including, you know, flushing Ukraine down the toilet, which is probably what his strategy is going to be. And then, the key thing really is if the US decides they're not going to support Ukraine anymore, to what extent is Europe going to support Ukraine or take over? And is that Trump's actual plan to get Europe and the UK to boost defense spending for Ukraine themselves?
I think Europe's the answer now, Charles. I think you've just hit the nail. I mean, I'm just looking at the paper here. The headline is Starmer threatens Putin with severe consequences if Russia attacks UK peacekeepers. And I think they've pulled together this 31-nation military force to provide these security guarantees to Kiev as part of a possible Trump-brokered peace deal between Russia and Ukraine. So I think you're absolutely right. I think the Europeans are going to be pretty much doing this alone.
But it's all about energy, surely, and resources. The fact of the matter is Europe was massively dependent on Russia. And, you know, I think Trump basically wants as low a price as possible for energy, because that's how he boosts his own economy. And the scenario is that I'm pretty sure the Russians are going to start delivering gas back to Germany in the next year or two. It'll happen. Now, will Europe, you know, be more defensive minded? Yes, and that's what Trump wants as well. So he's playing an aggressive game, and he's playing his cards on the basis that everything is America first, everything. And, you know, I'm not saying it's a good thing, but it is what it is.
Okay, and we also saw news that President Trump had signed an executive order on Thursday aimed at immediately increasing American production of critical minerals like uranium, copper, potash, and gold by invoking the Defense Production Act to expand leasing and development on federal lands. Do we know anyone that's well versed in talking about these kind of critical minerals? maybe we're actually joined by Oliver Fries and CEO of Guardian Metals. Welcome back to the podcast, Oliver.
There's a young guy who's very tall, and he's actually quite good looking. He's getting married this year, but other than that, I have no idea.
What an intro. Thank you, gents.
So tell us, Oliver, how's this going to impact Guardian Metal Resources with all of his assets on US soil? and in probably one of the best mined jurisdictions in the world, in Nevada.
Yeah, I mean it's definitely it's overwhelmingly positive for us. You know, I've been on my soapbox, my little soapbox here in the UK saying that, hey, you know, we're in the right place, which is Nevada, US, which is definitely further confirmed by the announcement overnight. And we're exploring for the right metal, tungsten, which is key for defense and national security and lots of other important industries at the right time with all this kind of going on and the need to reshore supply chains back on the US soil. So it's good to see, you know, a few more people sort of recognize that that is the case, that we are in a great position right now. The announcement pretty much came or landed quite late last night, UK time. So it's a bit of a mad scramble this morning to figure out exactly what it means for us. We're still digesting it. We have some meetings today booked to understand exactly what it means. But my read of it is there's a lot of things that can be directly applicable to Guardian Metal. And I think the one of the takeaways is that, you know, some of the timelines in that announcement were quite short, as in they're moving quickly. It's not, hey, well, let's do this in the next 6 months, 9 months. It's, hey, 30 days, 15 days, 10 days to start to have some answers for the President of the United States and some of the key administrators. So yeah, exciting times for Guardian Metal. I think if you look at the UK landscape of other companies that are positioned and can take advantage of this kind of excitement in the US on the critical metal space, there's not many of us. So yeah, it's exciting times ahead for Guardian Metal.
I guess you've got this situation where Trump is, I guess, annoying might be not be the right word, but it's the only word I can think of at the moment, annoying the allies in the West, the Canadians, the Australians, etc. And therefore, you know, if it's going to go down a difficult kind of negotiations route, then having domestic supplies of critical minerals is going to be critical for the US. So there's no leverage from other parties. And obviously that's tungsten, but you know, pretty much everything else as well. I mean, there's massive copper deposits in America, for example, that are probably going to get permitting soon. Just the whole landscape in America is changing very rapidly. Like, how are you negotiating for it?
Yeah, I mean, like you said, it's changing rapidly. You know, these announcements come out overnight without much forewarning. So it's just our job to sit down and understand what it means and work with our advisors and team who understand the US government and the DoD and a lot of the other important individuals on Capitol Hill. So it's where we're just rolling with the punches right now. We expected an announcement like this because there's been lots of speculation and lots of there's been a lot of talk about critical metals and reshoring. And like you said, Charles, so much of this is pointing to the fact that the US needs to reshore, it needs to build industry back again, it needs to start mining again. You know, when you look at just the tariff policies alone, I mean, as of April 2nd, if you want to import tungsten from China, who's currently their largest partner, or actually probably not at the moment, but you know, a year ago they were, we're talking about 45% tariffs. So you to look at whatever the spot price is, if you can even buy at that spot price, and then add 45%, and that's the landed cost. So the tariffs and everything else that's going on is really to support made in America, mined in America, American competitiveness. And these tariff, you know, revisions and also just this announcement really, I think, is showing that it's not just talk, they're actually walking the walk and they're really serious about reshoring supply chains back onto US soil. And tungsten's a metal, incredibly important for defense, but a lot of other important civilian technologies that hasn't been mined on US soil for over 10 years.
Well, I
And we
guess,
kind of
you
took
know,
a
this.
we took a contrarian view 5 years ago when no one cared about that metal. We positioned ourselves with Pilot, and then we took another kind of contrarian view, even, you know, 7, 8 months ago when we were working on acquiring Tempa Ute, which we've just closed recently, at a time when once again there was no one even looking at tungsten. And here we are now, the price is ticking up now, and the tailwinds from the US government are tremendous. So yeah, it's coming together, and it's great to see kind of, you know, a lot of the things that we thought or said were going to happen are starting to happen now.
Well, I think the thing is maybe tungsten is going to follow the antimony price, you know, and just rocket. It's what we're all hoping for. But I guess, you know, when we were talking in 2023, maybe you were looking further ahead. I mean, I looked at these Chinese export controls and I thought this is definitely going to happen, and they have. But back then, Guardian, the story was, right, we're going to get some grant funding from the US to develop a feasibility study for Pilot Mountain. Now you've taken on Tempa Ute and you've got UCAM, and the people backing, you know, behind UCAM are very serious people. You've gone from we want to develop a feasibility study for a tungsten asset to we want to corner the tungsten market in the United States of America. And that's a very, obviously, the market cap has rewarded that vision, but that's a very different kind of vision to what you were investing in maybe 18 months ago. So it's very ambitious and you can't put a step wrong. So far, you haven't. Do you feel a bit nervous at the moment, or are you too busy maybe to be nervous?
No, I'd say I'm probably the least nervous I've been now, because everything that we've thought was going to happen is starting to happen. When it came to, first of all, the election cycle and who was going to get in the office, that was, we were nervous about that. But now we're sort of seeing everything come together, and it sounds a bit cliched, but the stars are starting to align here. And you mentioned antimony, and that's kind of what I think really gave us the conviction about our tungsten story, was we saw this blueprint laid out for us in the antimony space, where China announced restrictions, the price started to move, and obviously it's now sort of a runaway train. The underlying equities, the US focused companies specifically, have performed incredibly well, and we're going, hey, we've seen this in antimony. We know that antimony and tungsten are two key defense metals, and specifically used in the production of munitions. Why can't this same blueprint be laid out for the tungsten space? And sure enough, a year and a half later, we're now seeing where, if you think about it as sort of a baseball game, antimony, whatever inning that is in, the sixth, seventh inning, tungsten is, it's, we're in the first inning right now, really, is how I look at it. Because, I've been on a lot of calls and a lot of meetings over the last few weeks, just trying to get the story out. And one of the things I always ask is at the start of the meeting, before I start, how much do you know about tungsten? How much do you know about guardian? And I would say 95% of the time, it's zero and zero,
Yeah,
which
it's
means
still
no one knows
years.
who, no one knows us. So that's how exciting is that? Because it's all going to start to come together. Tungsten prices are moving up here. Like I said, we're very early here, but that's the time to sort of get excited. And obviously, we put a lot of good building blocks in place. But this year, it's about really advancing the story and pushing forward our projects to construction as quickly as we can here.
When you say push forward as quickly as possible with Tempe, which is a brownfield site with a lot of infrastructure already, I mean, we had the RNS come out recently. We're talking about the valuation of the assets that you've acquired. But how much investment? I mean, I've speculated on this before, but how much investment and what kind of timeline are you looking at to get Tempe up and running and processing and generating revenue and spitting out tungsten? And there's another processing plant close by as well, I believe, that's been a for sale sign. There's more news to come.
Well, like I said, we're starting work on Tempayute next week, so we're not wasting any time here. When it comes to kind of the CapEx and the timelines, I won't expose too much, but what I can say, in my sort of the most diplomatic way possible, we put out the press release earlier this week talking about the in-place infrastructure. The key takeaway there, I think, for our investors and those following the story, is the fact that our engineers have confirmed that everything that they saw in place is effectively usable. So it's not like a bunch of stuff that's going to have to be ripped out. It's all stuff that we can utilize and then just build on top of. So number one, that saves, tremendously on the CapEx side, but also more importantly, is on the timeline side. For instance, just even a mill foundation itself, to build a mill foundation, you have to drill multiple geotech holes. If the soil's not stable enough, you have to move it. That's a process that can take months. We have that in place at Tempayute. So the infrastructure is all usable. It was actually really encouraging to see the engineers that I was with, the Guardian engineers who have built mines in Nevada. And they were like kids in a candy store running around this mine and saying, hey, we can use this, we can use this, we can use this. I mean, it's all in good shape. So that's exciting. But also, on the timeline side, the other thing, just to, and I've mentioned this a few times, but I think it's not fully recognized by the market yet, is the claim ownership. It's on what's called private or patented mining claims, which means you can move permitting forward very, very quickly, much quicker than compared to BLM or Forest Service ground. So, for
Sorry,
instance, on
why is
patent.
that?
So the reason is, it's you actually have not just the mineral rights, but the surface rights as well. So
Okay.
if you try to go to, and just so the backstory of these types of claims are actually quite unique. Back in the 20s and 30s and 40s and 50s and 60s, if you were mining in the US and you had a little small scale operation, you could apply for the patented mining claims or the private mining claims. However, I think it was actually in the 60s that the government abolished those claims. They were too good. There was too many things that you could do on those claims because you own the surface rights as well. However, if you had patented mining claims already granted before they were abolished, you were
The
grandfathered
grandfathering
in.
rights, yeah.
Exactly. So they haven't issued any more patented mining claims in the US since that date. However, if you can get your hands on these claims, which they're very rare, because you had to have an operation going in the 60s and 70s, or I think it was the 60s is when they abolished it. But you have the surface rights. So we actually, it's the same as owning property in Nevada. Like if you own a house in Las Vegas, you have the surface rights. So we own the surface rights as well as the patent, as well as the mineral rights. So for instance, if you try to go to Temple Ute right now, there's a fence around it that says no trespassing private property. The importance of that is the BLM, so the Bureau of Land Management is a federal agency. Now, for instance, Pilot Mountain is on BLM ground. So we permit at the state level with the state of Nevada for our state permits, but also with the BLM for our federal permits. When you have patented mining claims, you effectively only have to permit with the state. So the BLM doesn't have nearly as much jurisdiction on patented mining claims. And this is one of the reasons why they abolish them, because it means you can move really, really quickly. Like, for instance, in theory, you could show up at Tempa Ute today, or we could, and you could start drilling without, you don't need permits. You can, it's, you own the private land, so you can just start
It's just
drilling right
private
away.
land, yeah.
Almost like
Yeah,
a
like,
leasehold freehold situation or something like that, it sounds like in
yeah,
property.
that's kind of the UK equivalent. So, like I said, you don't see these claims very often. Like most companies, if you look around in the US, will not have these patents. But if they do have them, there's so much more that you can do, and you can move so much more quickly. So we're trying to get that story out, and it's happening slowly. But that's one of the main reasons why we were so attracted to Tempa Ute, was the infrastructure, but also the patented claims, which are very, very valuable, especially right now when things are trying to move quickly.
Yeah, one of the takeaway sort of comments on in the RNS that I saw was you mentioned this co-flagship on the evaluation, which I assume means that the company now considers the two projects sort of equal importance and central to the strategy, rather than just saying, you know, one is the flagship and effectively they're both leading assets. So in Guardian's case, I'm assuming it means that Tempa will be developed alongside the Pilot Mountain project with, you know, equal focus, resource, and strategic priorities. Is that right?
Yeah, 100%. You know, having the engineers on site, kind of getting the team up to speed on the opportunity, it became abundantly clear very quickly that the opportunity here is tremendous. So we'd be remiss to not push them forward in tandem or in parallel, whatever you want to call it. But as you mentioned, they'll receive equal attention because we have a huge opportunity here. You know, we have a window. You know, Trump is in office for the next, you know, less just less than 4 years now, and we think there's an opportunity there where the need to reshore is going to be what it is now. I mean, just the executive order that you see overnight. Not to say that this won't continue past his administration, but right now we have an opportunity where tungsten prices are going up, and there's a huge tailwind coming from the government to push defense critical, you name it, metal supply chains back on the US soil, and we've positioned ourselves expertly in the tungsten space in the US.
So Oliver, if you were able to look 4 years ahead, do you anticipate that both Pilot Mountain and Tempa Ute will be producing tungsten in the US?
What I can say is we have built our portfolio to move quickly. Like I said, that we know that there's a window here, a tremendous window, and we want to jump through it. So we've built a portfolio, and like I said, with Tempa Ute, there was a lot of other assets we looked at. And one of the reasons why Tempa Ute was so attractive was because of the patented claims and the infrastructure, which means we can move very quickly. So our job here is to continue to de-risk these assets, push them forward. We're going to be full steam ahead on Tempa Ute now, alongside Pilot, where we've been full steam ahead for the last year. And yeah, our goal here is to make a lot of moves and really be the solution, or a huge part of the solution, for the US tungsten landscape. And these two projects position us perfectly to do that.
And now the market cap's achieved the 50 million market cap in the UK. On Friday, as we speak, it's gone past that. You're going to be open now to, you know, small cap funds and small cap institutions, if you like, that really don't look at anything that is smaller than that. So, do you anticipate some inflows from that? Not necessarily giving you money or. More buying in the market, I presume.
Yeah, I mean, on the institutional side, that is what can really move the needle for companies, because obviously the amount of capital that those those groups can deploy is, typically is much larger than the retail audience. So, what's interesting is since we IPO'd, I've been pretty much banging down every door. Anyone that will listen to me, I've been in those rooms. And even when we were 10, 20, 30 million pound market cap. And so a lot of the institutions that you're referring to already know of the story. And sort of the takeaway from a lot of those meetings was, hey, we love the story, we love the macro. When you're a little bit bigger, come back to us. So we've already laid a lot of that groundwork with some of these institutions who, as you mentioned now, kind of above the threshold we're at now, they start to get interested and it's sort of above their mandate. So we'll see what happens there. But like I said, we've been, and myself personally, across London pretty much every week for the last 2 years have been in these meetings, getting the story out there. It takes time. It's a slow burn, as you know. But now that we're at a certain level, there's going to be lots of emails being sent out to some of those institutional contacts to say, hey, we met a year ago, we met 6 months ago, whatever it is. Here's everything that's happened. Here's what's going on in the story now. Let's go. Let me come back and we'll do a refresher and talk about all the great things that we're planning on doing this year and beyond.
And if you were to do your triple jump now, hop, skip, and a jump, what are the next three hop, skips, and jumps?
So I would say continuing to align with the US government. I'll leave it at that, but we're doing a lot
That
in that.
surely doesn't mean that you're going to get a grant. Surely.
I mean, there's not even like a public slide out there that tells you exactly
Okay.
when it's going to be
This is
down the month.
this
I
is
mean,
hot.
it's so clear that you look go to Capitol Hill, you look at the DoD's inclusion in that announcement. Everyone is grouping now to figure out how we can solve this issue. So we obviously align very closely with that mandate. So that's all I'll say on that front.
Oh, come on. How
Yeah.
can we solve this issue? Oh, here's the largest undeveloped tungsten deposit in the US.
Yeah.
Oh, the
So.
company needs to drill it and needs to get a feasibility study and then get it mined. Oh,
Yeah.
what could the
That's
solution be? I wonder.
the story that we're telling. So,
Yeah.
yeah, that's a big part of what we're doing now is making sure that we're kind of in the right rooms and talking to the right people, which I believe we are, but we can continue doing that. Tempaiute, I think that's the next big step here is I think trying to really get that story out. I think it's still if GMET is unknown, Tempaiute, no one even has ever heard of it. So we're still working on getting that story out, but more importantly, getting the work started, which is beginning next week. The other two things that I haven't even mentioned today is the fact that there's existing tailings facility there on site, which we have ownership of. And then also there's high-grade stockpiles that weren't processed during the operations in the 1980s that are just sitting there at surface. So we want to understand exactly how much material is there, but we have sampled it, and the DD sampling that we released a few months ago covers some of those results, and there's some exciting stuff there. So Tempaiute, and then I would say a pilot, just cracking on and pushing towards the PFS, which is obviously an important study for us, and we're working very, very hard behind the scenes to move that forward and get that done as quickly as we can.
So you are going to be the tungsten company. Okay, this is what Guardian Metal Resources is. So when we talk about the cat and Golconda, as in Garfield and Golconda, what is the best way forward for you? Because really, you shouldn't be dispersed into lots of other things. So is there the opportunity there to have a JV on some of those things so that you're not distracted by those things, but we still get the upside. What's your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think we've sat down as a board and looked at the opportunity ahead, and it was abundantly clear. And this is many, many months ago, obviously, before we acquired Tempaiute, but we felt like we had the best opportunity in tungsten, in US tungsten. When it comes to copper, when it comes to gold, there's lots of other companies doing copper, doing gold in the US, obviously, but there's no one else doing tungsten. So we thought, hey, you know what? We position ourselves. We have an LOI offtake with the GTP. We have, what's believed to be the largest undeveloped tungsten deposit. And even at that time, no one else that we knew of was in the tungsten space or even looking. So that's the decision that we made as a team was, hey, you know what? If we really want to drive shareholder value and do something special here, we think that tungsten affords us the best opportunity to do that. So that's why we've I almost want to say we've doubled down, but we've really increased our reach in the tungsten space. So what that means is that, as you mentioned, Garfield and Golconda, two very, very good assets. And a lot of our shareholders from the earlier days will remember all the great stuff we did at Garfield. Now, both of those projects are drill ready now. I wouldn't say we're in a huge rush. I mean, the holding cost for those properties is very, very little. Gold happens to be above $3,000 an ounce now, and copper above $5. So they're fantastic opportunities. One way or another, we will ensure that our investors, especially those who backed us in the early days when we were talking about Garfield and doing some work there, will get exposed to further exploration. Now, whether that's a JV or an option, the plan and what the goal would be is to find a good company, and there is quite a bit of interest right now, as you can imagine, to take on those assets. They fund the drilling and the accepts exploration, and we retain some sort of ownership or some sort of mechanism so our shareholders get exposed to the upside in the event that a discovery is made on either of those. So we're holding tight. We have some pretty some good interest in both those, as you can imagine, because they're great assets. But that kind of allows us to really focus on tungsten and the task at hand. But we're pushing forward and making sure that we can monetize those assets to the benefit of our shareholders as well.
I've got one more question. Last question for me. It's a kind of a corporate finance question. The warrants are all in the money, and if they all get exercised, worth maybe £4.5 million. Grant funding we're hoping to get, and I know you can't talk about it, but hoping to get relatively shortly. UCAM is now a major shareholder, and they tend to fund the projects that they buy shares into. And I guess the question is, what kind of active conversations are you having around funding, getting these assets into production? Beyond grant funding, or can you not discuss those yet?
What I would say, and just to, I might have misheard you there, Charles, but we have about 2 million pounds of warrants that are in the money. I
Is it
think you might
only
have
two
said
million?
four. It's about 2 million. But anyways, yes, the warrants expire early May, so that's something that we're working on now, is getting those in the door. In terms of next steps, we have some big things that we're working on. In terms of Pilot Mountain, in terms of Tempa, there's some things ahead of us here that we're really focused on right now and really head down on. So the key is to kind of get that all finalized and then kind of see how things shape up from there. What I would say is that, there is a lot of interest in the US. You look at some of the market caps of the companies, exploring and operating in the rare earths and critical metal space. And there's a lot of interest, especially in the US, as you can imagine. I mean, if you're an American citizen who voted for Trump and you're hearing him talk about the importance of critical metals and reshoring really every week, and sometimes some weeks every day, you can understand why, companies like ours are positioned really well. So what we really want to do is broaden and expand our reach in the US, looking at other listing opportunities in the US that could give us more exposure. We're looking at that very closely right now. So we're not, when it comes to those discussions, there is a lot of interest. What I'll say is that with every raise that we've done, and I encourage listeners who don't know the story to go back and look at every single subsequent raise we've done since our IPO, and that's what we do. We respect our current shareholders. We fight tooth and nail when it comes to financing opportunities that arise. We've been in a very strong position, which has allowed us to do multiple raises at a premium with no warrant. And our position has gotten only stronger. So whenever those discussions do continue and pick up, at the timing that suits us, we'll be making sure that those who are currently in the story are respected, which includes myself and the management team. We're shareholders, and we want to minimize dilution as well. So I'll leave it at that. But the position we're in now is fantastic, and I think it's going to be a great year and a few years ahead for us.
Fantastic. Thank you.
You're a good politician, Oliver. Well said.
Good. Well, no, I mean, it's great to have you back on, Oliver, and give you your insights on the updates. You've got some very exciting projects, and just keep on doing what you're doing. And it's great to hear you back.
Right on. Yeah, appreciate the time, gents, and lots going on. So let's catch up again soon.
Yeah, Oliver Friesen, CEO of Guardian Metal Resources. Thanks very much for appearing on the podcast.
Yeah, cheers.
So let's move on to our guest this week. We're delighted to welcome back Shaun Day, MD of Greatland Gold. Welcome back to the podcast, Shaun.
Phil, great to see you again. I really appreciate you taking the time to catch up together with Kevin and Charles.
Absolutely. I mean, before we move on to the latest news from Greatland, I want to just get your thoughts on something. You know, we've been discussing obviously that the sort of price of gold and gold hitting all-time highs, a bit of a double-edged sword, because while it's often seen as a safe haven, its sharp rise is usually a reflection of deeper issues, you know, geopolitical tensions, uncertainty with maybe the US economy and the weakening dollar, or fears of financial instability. Historically, gold prices surge when investors lose confidence in traditional markets, currencies, or global stability. What are your thoughts on the performance of gold in the last sort of 6 months, Sean?
Just to comment maybe more broadly than just the 6 months, I'll take it to there. But I think during the Cold War with the USSR, yeah, I think gold was a very good proxy for geopolitical tension. I think between Cold Wars, gold became more correlated with real US interest rates. I think as we've entered into the new Cold War with China, you've seen gold dominated again, or gold price being dominated again by geopolitical tensions over the last, you know, 3 to, well, 8, 9 years. And then I think what's really kind of poured the kerosene onto the fire is a Trump administration, which is le considered less predictable. And although I think will remain staunchly part of NATO, has certainly undermined some of the cultural underlying nature of NATO. So I think, you know, Trump, you know, the concept of tariffs, the unpredictability, I think has certainly added to geopolitical concerns and volatility, and that is clearly supportive of gold.
Absolutely. Yeah, great answer. So obviously, let's look at the latest news from Greatland. The company recently announced its 2024 group mineral resource estimate, including the inaugural estimate for the Telfer gold copper mine, confirming 3.2 million ounces of gold and 117,000 tons of copper, reinforcing Telfer's mine life extension potential. Total group resources now stand at 10.2 million ounces of gold and 387,000 tons of copper, a circa 40% increase. The Telfer MRE, completed within 15 weeks of the acquisition, underpins Greatland's strategy to integrate Havieron and Telfer. Key next steps include an inaugural Telfer ore reserve estimate in June 2025 and ongoing drilling to upgrade and expand resources. Sean, you highlighted the strong foundation of Greatland's growth as an Australian gold and copper producer. You must be blown away by this upgrade, Sean. The inaugural Telfer MRE has added 3.2 million ounces and 117,000 tons. How does this compare with your expectations, you know, pre-acquisition, and what does it mean for the mine's long-term viability?
Yeah, look, I it's a cracking result. Yeah, we're really pleased by it. In terms of how does it compare to what I'd seen, you know, it's what it really is confirmation or vindication of what I felt we were seeing through the due diligence period on Telfer. What's really satisfying is then to have the technical resource geologists come in and confirm that in accordance with the JORC code. So not necess so I think it's very consistent with what we thought we saw during the due diligence. And what I might add to that is this update to the resource can is defined by what's in it, but equally by what's not in it. In just 15 weeks, we had time to do the West Dome open pit, or a large part of it. We had time to do some of the A Reef type area in that main pit underground, but we didn't have time to do the main dome open pit. We didn't have time to do the big zonations of the eastern stockwork and vertical stockwork in the main dome underground, and we didn't have time to bring in that new, I think, very exciting high grade West Dome underground. So for all we've brought in, and it's huge, there's a lot more to be brought in the future. So 15 weeks, I think, as I said, it's a pretty tremendous result, and putting us over 10 million ounces, 10.2 million ounces, plus what, you know, 375,000 tons of copper in that same ore zonation is tremendous.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you also highlighted Telfer's mine life extension potential. So based on this resource estimate, how many additional years of production do you kind of envisage or foresee?
Oh, look, I think when we think about it, we bought this with 15 months of mine life. I people were concerned there'd be a gap before we brought on Havron late 27, let's just call that calendar year 28. So there's 3 years. I think it just should give everyone a lot of confidence that, there's no need to mine the gap. It will be full. And if you look at that resource, I think it was 185 million tons. The site can process 20 million tons a year or up to. I think there should be a lot of confidence that we can bridge that gap. Plus, we have 35 million tons of stockpile, or at least 25 million tons of stockpile that were not included. That in itself is more than a year of filling that gap. But I suspect we don't need to use all that stockpile. We'll be able to extend the life of that stockpile out for a long time.
Yeah. So how does this new resource estimate, fit into the broader strategy of kind of integrating Havieron and Telfer, and what efficiencies or synergies do you expect from running them together?
Well, I think that's a really insightful question. I think one of the defining features of Greatland is that we will run Telfer and Havieron as a single unit. This is effectively a single mine, the processing plant being fed by the Havieron underground, the Telfer underground, and the Telfer open pit, and perhaps some stockpile. So yeah, I think the synergies are really good. One management, one procurement team, one geological team, one mining engineering, one planning team, one safety team, right through the ability to be able to swap in and exchange equipment. I think it's very likely we'll have the same underground mining group or contractor at Telfer Underground and Havieron Underground. All of that just creates for a really simple but efficient operation.
So, Sean, you've moved from explorer to producing a mine, as in Havieron, to now effectively a gold producer, gold pourer, gold copper, and I emphasize the copper now. We've just seen copper go over $5 a ton. But you're going to become a mammoth cash flow business. Surely Telfer and Havieron are not going to be where the horizon stops.
Yeah, correct. Look, so gold over $3,000 US an ounce and copper over $10,000 a ton is exceptional and are expansionary indicators for our business. Look, we have a very clear path ahead of us in the short to medium term, which is complete our integration and demonstrate the life and cash flow potential of Telfer. Bring out the Havieron feasibility study and really demonstrate what Greatland thinks Havieron looks like in the market. And then we build a platform. We like to think we re-rate and get a value more akin to our ASX peers, which trade at a higher value than maybe what you presently observe Greatland trading at. So, we think that sets us up for long. A platform for long-term success and complementing the Havieron Telfer base, I think is something that we'd really want to understand the opportunities to do that in a financially disciplined way that creates shareholder value.
Yeah, and ultimately, if you don't re-rate, which I fully expect that you will, but if you don't re-rate, then you're going to be a juicy, crispy apple for someone just to pick, because you're going to be cash flow positive. You're going to have, as you've already stated, over 10 million ounces of gold with copper added, etc., etc. But there's all sorts of things going on in the market, such as you will probably join the ASX 200 based on the valuation you have now. There's going to be a need for many of these tracking funds included in the ASX 200 to buy you. So there are many, 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 many initiatives. Do you anticipate when you list in Australia that there's going to be a lot more shares? Are you going to raise any money, or you've no need to do that?
Oh, look, we think our present cash position gives us a really clear pathway to funding. And remember, in terms of Havieron, we actually have 12 quarters, potentially 12 quarters of free cash flow generation ahead of needing to pay all the CapEx to put that into production. So We don't want to comment on whether we're fully funded until we bring out the feasibility study, but there does appear to be a rationale.
But you are. But you don't want to say it.
And we've got a $750 million project financing facility. Now, that's subject to that feasibility study, but that with the $150 million we already have in the bank, or $145, we already have $900 million available to solve an $800 million puzzle, but let's wait till we finalise the feasibility study, confirm the CapEx, confirm the timeframes before we are expansive in our comments there. But what I'd like to see is free cash flow generation, which puts downward pressure on the amount of debt we need to draw, so we don't have a lot of debt drawn. We're lightly geared, and that gives us a lot of contingency and confidence that we can deliver Havieron for our shareholders. In terms of the ASX listing, that means we don't really feel we need any new primary issuance. So potentially it's a compliance listing where you list but you don't raise any money. The ASX can have a market interest test where you need to just demonstrate you can raise some money. It's typically a very low threshold to achieve that. They don't designate a number, but you know, say 1%, less than 2%. So that wouldn't really create an overhang. It would be a very small amount relative to our size. So that's how we think about it in terms of, you know, primary issuance. We don't want to dilute. We want to build our share price. We'll give it every opportunity to grow. And we don't feel we need the additional cash inflows at this point in time and at the current gold price. What this is about is engaging with Australian investors and giving them an opportunity to add demand, add new buying to our screen, our trading screen.
18 months ago, could you have believed that you were in this situation where you now have both of these properties, gold over $3,000 an ounce, or nearly $5,000 Australian ounce, and now copper doing its stuff as well? You couldn't have wished for a better situation, surely.
Well, I think that there's two halves to that. Like the first half of that, could have I wished or expected to own Havieron Telfer? I think I've been on your program for the last 4 years describing just that. So this is exactly what I joined the company to do. So very much envisage this. I don't think anyone had the confidence it was going to be achieved that I had. But you do need someone with conviction to believe they can deliver on the vision. Yeah. So the first half of that, absolutely, Kevin. Not just thought it might be possible, expected it to be possible to be delivered. Gold price and copper price, I'm a little bit more measured in terms of trying to crystal ball markets. To some extent, it's a random walk, but certainly it's no bad thing that when you buy a large gold asset and, you know, over 10 million ounces of gold and 365,000 tons of copper demonstrated to JORC, that you're at all-time high gold prices and I think all-time high copper prices.
Very now, close, yeah.
That is advantageous.
Yeah,
it's a nice tailwind.
Yeah, for sure. It is going to put you in a position, I'm sure, where the, even though I know you can't say it, the cash flow should allow you to have minimal debt for Havieron or possibly some debt for Havieron, but then give you a war chest to do other things, because you are ambitious and I'm quite sure this isn't the end of the game. But I'll let Charles ask a few questions.
Go talking of war chest, I mean, the rumours are going around now that Agnico Eagle are interested in Northern Star. And obviously you'll know Northern Star intimately. And I guess there's a lot of assets there that Greatland might be interested in. And so, you know, you're talking about, you know, taking the long-term view, but this might be in the quite near term. So how would you deal with that strategically, potentially, if that comes to pass?
Oh, look, I certainly couldn't comment on speculation. It's an interesting rumor. I hadn't really heard it, so I don't think that is a widespread or widely held view that will happen. But you know, all things are possible. look, as it happens, I know those assets very well. So, you know, we'd be a great partner for Agnico Eagle as we were for Newmont. But I think that is crystal ball stuff, and I'm just not very good at predicting the future. And you know, what we're focused on is becoming a reliable and consistent producer at Telfer Havieron.
The wonderful crystal ball. I mean, I've got another crystal ball question for you that you're welcome to ignore as well. But when you took over Telfer, you also took O'Callaghans, which is one of the largest tungsten deposits in Australia. Tungsten is also kind of racing ahead because of the Chinese export ban. And I guess my question is, obviously, this is not a near-term strategically important thing to do. But back in 2012, when they were, when Newcrest even was talking about O'Callaghans kind of in detail, they were saying that, if you brought it online, yes, it'd be quite expensive to bring it online, but it would bring down the cost of gold production at Telfer quite substantially, and also have the tungsten production too. So I guess, is that on your horizon, or is that nowhere near close yet?
Yeah, look, I yeah, look, it is something I've spent a little bit of time thinking about. O'Callaghans is interesting for a number of reasons. It's interesting because it is the world's largest tungsten deposit outside of China, and I believe highest grade. China has weaponized tungsten, so clearly a deposit, in the West, I think has particular strategic and economic interest right now. In addition, although it's been explored, there's actually a really very significant geophysical confluence of magnetic and gravity, under O'Callaghans. The O'Callaghans, as it's been drilled, doesn't explain that anomaly, mere fraction of it. So I think that's really exciting as well. We really want to understand that deposit better, and I think understand how we can create value for Greatland shareholders, not necessarily by Greatland developing it, although that is a pathway, but certainly something where we're kind of open to business to understand how we can unlock value there, because it is an interesting asset. And again, we're taking the drill rigs in the Paterson insight from 2 to 4 to 6, but also and potentially more, so we're tripling the number of rigs, but also in that regional exploration, which I'd count O'Callaghans in, I think you'll see us increase activity. Now that we're generating free cash flow, we can invest in the drill bit, and I think that's exciting, and O'Callaghans is one of those opportunities which is exciting.
I guess you're surrounded by companies on the ASX or in Canada as well, all of which are saying, oh, we might have the next Havieron, we might have the next Telfer. And every single one of them are probably trying to get on the phone to you saying, come drill us, Sean. And I guess the question is, obviously, you're drilling your own tenure, you've massively increased exploration, but what's the long-term goal for the province? Because you've got the largest processing plant in the Paterson. It was the third largest in Australia. And I guess the question is, how are you going to future-proof it? Is it going to be exploring the entire region? Are you the king of the hill?
Look, we will be systematic in exploring it, and yeah, we'd love to be king of the hill. But the equally, we are open for business. As you say, we have an expansive holding up there. Look, we can systematically work through that over 10, 20, decades. But I'd like to create shareholder value, in the next, 1, 2, 3 years for people, plus create that longer pathway. So I think we are massively open for business with junior explorers. That was Greatland once upon a time. Newcrest, released land, and ultimately it was a Greatland company that came in and found, what I think will be plus 10 million ounces. So at Havieron. So if we can bring in smaller groups that are hungry, focused on smaller parts of our tenure, and will accelerate drilling. Because while we are trying to, we might be in other areas, they are going to focus on a smaller patch and do it justice and drill a number of targets. And just like Havieron demonstrates, Telfer is a monopoly provider of infrastructure in the Paterson.
Yes.
We will be popping champagne corks if someone else finds another Telfer, another Havron, or even something smaller, because it will ultimately come through our mill. And we will be sensible and realistic how we deal with people, but that will create huge value for Greatland and its shareholders if other deposits. It's already a 30 million ounce province that is globally significant. And as people have heard me say before, cover is our friend. I mentioned the geotech at O'Callaghan's. Greatland, and Callum Baxter deserves the credit here, originally found Havron through geotech, I'm sorry, geophysical interpretation. We think it's a strength of ours. We think that cover actually means there can still be really big ore bodies out in the Paterson. So it's a great postcode. It's elephant country. We love exploration there.
I think
My
it's
last.
more likely a tinny, Sean, than champagne, to be honest. But I was going to ask you the question. You've been in this situation before, obviously, with Northern Star. Is this a better opportunity than what you took over at Northern Star?
Well, what I think I can say is, and I don't think Bill would be uncomfortable with me, our starting asset, Telfer, is better than what Paulsens was. This is, a top five, well, certainly top 10, Australian gold asset. It's a ripper. We have Havron, which I think is unparalleled in the mid-cap space, 20-year mine life, lowest all-in sustaining cost, brownfield development. That, my friends, is as good as it gets. So our first two assets are an unbelievable start. Now, we haven't earned the right to compare ourselves with Northern Star. Northern Star's built up, six, seven assets. They do that very well. I'm hugely respectful of that platform and grateful for my opportunity to be a part and contribute to its growth as one of the senior executives. But ultimately, we've got a lot to achieve to catch that up. But that's a great ambition to have. But that's not our benchmark. Our benchmark is about creating value with what we have. And if and I think I've got a great track record at financially disciplined acquisitions, not just at Greatland, not just at Northern Star, but Sukari and Straits before that. If we can apply that financial discipline and find value in the market and can create amplified value for shareholders, of course I'm interested.
Okay, I think we've put the world to rights there, and obviously it's great to have you on, Sean, and hear your insights on the future of Greatland. And we'll just say, Sean Day, MD of Greatland Gold, thanks very much for appearing on the podcast.
I really appreciate the time, everyone, and hopefully that gave you a great update on the company. Thanks again.
So let's have a look at some of the movers and shakers of the week. Through Vision Group up 122%. Usual no reason for share price movement RNS, but in that same RNS, they stated that the group has recently received several orders from customers in the US, Indonesia, and Europe, and further orders are anticipated before the end of the financial year. PR1, Priority Intelligence Group, up 92% on the week. I mean, this comes after quite a large drop back from the IPO, doesn't it? I think they were trading around the 3 pence mark around this time last week, and they were up to about 7, 7.5 pence trading. So yeah, circa 92%. What do we make of that? Is that based on the announcement with leukemia research?
I think, yeah, I mean, it's signing up leukemia research, which is, kind of a big deal, obviously. But it's also it's the now you've got to the revenue point of 250,000. You're roughly halfway to covering corporate costs, and that's only in a few months. So if this revenue trajectory continues and we get more RNSs, then people are looking at it and going, down here. Well, back when it was sort of 3.5p, that's cheap. For a pump, effectively, on AI companies. And I mentioned it before, if you look at GenIP, which is another company that IPO'd, sorry, last year, they went below their IPO price and then they bounced back. And I think often that is the case. I mean, there's no hiding the Priority AI. There were shares that should have been locked in, weren't locked in effectively. But now it is free to rise and it has risen and you haven't seen more selling. So I think that I wrote an article on it a month or so ago calling the bottom. It wasn't quite the bottom yet, but we're now up from when that article was written. Hopefully we can get back to the IPO price in the next month or two and then move on to greater things.
Yeah, I think that's a good summation. I think, the contracts that they managed to get with the charity, the leukemia charity, is excellent. But I think the bigger picture is there's going to be more charities joining the game, I think, so it's not just a one charity. I know that and I know for a fact that there was other people, basically getting demonstrations from that scenario. And then you're also looking at the sports angle, which they're now looking at with this Capitano thing, that they've had a lot of inbound inquiries, as they said in the interview. So I think, even just with those groups, then the potential is pretty huge. It's like, I mean, I think the 250,000 revenue could be the tip of the iceberg if that's the case. And as you said, Charles, that I think if the RNSs keep coming out saying we've done XYZ, then people's confidence in them being able to be cash flow positive and then grow the business is going to be higher and higher as time goes by. So let's see what happens over the next few months.
We also had Galilea Resources up circa 20% on the announcement of the mining license issued for the Kashitu project in Zambia. What do we make of that news?
Mining license tends to mean, come just before some kind of joint venture deal. And a joint venture deal means revenue, and the revenue means profit. So often, sometimes it takes more time than you think. But people have been waiting. I mean, it's the same with the other companies in Kolomba stable. You've been waiting for mining licenses like buses for a long time, and now you've got about 1,000 of them at once.
Do you think
So
2025 is going to be the year for Colin? Not that he's not delivered, in the past, but do you think that some of these
oh,
companies
it's
like the
about the share
Tesla
price
Resources,
appreciation, isn't it?
extract? We need to see some 4, 5, 10x's on some of these companies this
I
year.
think it could be this year. I really think it could be. I think that the Silver King assays from Extract could be very, very interesting. Plus the antimony licenses. I think that when you look at Bazant and the profit potential from Hope and Gorob, that's also very promising. We look at African Pioneer, its share prices, its market cap is under 2 million, but it's got some of the best licenses in Zambia when you look at positioning. And then, this news for Galileo. So yes, I think 2025 could be the year for Colin portfolio. And just more widely, if one of those companies takes off, the rest of them will probably be not far behind. So, let's hope, cross our fingers.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. I think there's big potential in Extract. There's big potential in Galileo. As you said, you've got Sobi, you've got the other assets, Shinganda, and they're cashed up. I think the interesting thing is if any of these companies start to use their cash in a positive way, you're looking about Extract, Silver King, and you're looking at what he's doing with the antimony, which I think people need to look at that and realize that Extract could be come a player for the antimony in Morocco. And then you've got African Pioneer with the copper in Umbongo, and then you've got Bazant, which I think that's an any day thing now, to be honest, that license is gonna the final part of that license, because the license is being granted. Don't misunderstand the system there. The license is granted. The only thing is the tick box and the signature of the environmental thing of the part of the license in Namibia, and then it'll be set to talk about how it's going to be financed, and on it goes there for Bazant in Hope and Gorup. So yeah, I think I personally think in the next, let's say, 3 months, there's going to be big movement in quite a few of those companies. So yeah, I think 2025 could be the start, because I do think 25, 26 for all of those four companies I've just mentioned, they're gonna produce big returns, I think, especially from these crazy lows.
Good. Yeah, I mean the biggest shaker of the week was Alpha Growth. It's a company we've talked about in the past, but they noted their intention to delist from the London Stock Exchange, and they're down circa 80% on the week. I think there's a lot of frustration if you read the RNS where they talk about the fact that there really has been a big disparity between their assets under management and the actual valuation. of the company, which has been afforded many opportunities for growth. So the directors are obviously very disappointed that the progress has not been reflected in that share price, and they've made decision to basically, to
So they're
delist.
going private.
Going private, absolutely, yeah. I mean,
That
it's
was
not
the
the
company
first.
that was doing the sort of death insurance policy part, and but they turned it more into a funds under management business as well, didn't they?
But I think this is it's quite a common theme when companies delist from AIM is the valuation disconnect, and they feel they can get better funding privately. I mean, the flip side of that, I work with private equity firms, and they've got companies that they want to IPO because they need the IPOs to get the liquidity to get their money out. You can say, "Oh, my private company's worth 100 million," but if the market doesn't say that, then good luck getting that money from it. And so you've got this massive queue of, biotech, particularly IPOs and tech IPOs, that they don't want to IPO into this market, but then they're kind of going to be forced to over the next 12 to 18 months because they need to realize liquidity. And I guess the only question is, are we going to have more listings or delistings? We're starting to see a bit of the IPO activity pick up on the AIM market now.
Yes.
And I think that'll continue, especially if American exceptionalism is out the window.
Yeah,
So let's
absolutely.
hope
Yeah. I mean,
so.
we saw Wellnex announced listing, a dual listing actually, on Friday as well. And as you say, they've seen a couple of announcements in the past week that have with companies intending to list on the AIM market. So that's very, very interesting. But there's one thing I want to ask you about, Charles, that made the headlines this week, and that's the UK investment scene. Some eye-popping news from the world of stocks and shares, ISAs. According to HMRC figures crunched by the money app Plum, the top stocks and shares ISA investors are sitting on some serious wealth. The average value of the top 25 of these accounts clocks in at a whopping £8.8 million. Compare that to the top 25 cash ISAs, which averaged about £650,000, and you're looking at fortunes over 13 times larger. That's a stark illustration of how equity investments have outpaced cash savings for the savviest players. The entry ticket to this top 25 club for stocks and shares ISAs is £5.1 million, while cash ISA elites need at least £500,000. With over 80 million people holding cash ISAs totaling nearly £300 billion, these numbers show just how much potential there is in stocks for those willing to take the plunge. So obviously we saw the news alongside this relief for cash ISA holders. Rumors have been swirling around that Chancellor Rachel Reeves might slash the annual cash ISA allowance from £20,000 to as low as £4,000 to nudge savers towards equities. But the Treasury is hitting pause, which obviously means any changes are now off the table until at least April 2026. So what do you make of that kind of stay of execution that a lot of savers have, been saved from?
Well, I think one of the key things to understand is that we're all still relatively, I say relatively young, we're getting older now. But we talk about equities, and over the longer term, historically, and past performance is not a guarantee of future results, et cetera, but historically, equities have outpaced cash. So you should be invested in stocks and shares if you're younger and you're able to ride out the dips and the peaks. The thing is with the cash ISAs, I mean, the problem is it's this comparison that the newspapers are making. They don't understand that they have different purposes, right? So, for example, people might use a lifetime ISA or a cash ISA to save money to put up deposit on a house, in which case the cash ISA deposits are probably going to be less than 100 grand, most of them, because it's money they're going to want to need in the next 3 to 5 years, and you may not be able to ride out the volatility of the stock market. Say, for example, you put your, you were saving up for a house deposit just before the dot-com crash, and then you lost 80% of your money. That being said, I do think we should be encouraging people to invest in stocks and shares. And I think there's two things that you can immediately do. The first is to scrap stamp duty on UK shares, which disincentivizes UK investment massively and is a tax on growth that would pay for itself if you just slashed it. And the second is, if you just scrapped cash ISAs as a product, but maintain stocks and shares ISAs and said, "Look, your allowance is still 20 grand, and you can get interest free if you just retain the cash in the stocks and shares ISA." So it's just a rebranding model, which is already what happens with, IG, for example, or Trading 212. Most, if you hold the money as cash in stocks and shares ISA, they'll pay you tax-free cash anyway. So just get rid, I personally, I would get rid of all of the ISA types and just have one ISA type, which is for stocks and shares ISA. If you want to keep it in cash, you can, and just get a return. But basically, you want to encourage people to invest in diversified equities, and they'll get a better return. And one of the big things in the UK is that the ISA, there's nothing like it in the world. People don't understand this. I mean, you can go to Australia or America or wherever else, and the ISA is pretty much the only account where it's tax advantaged. And yes, you're putting money in that's already been taxed from your income, but the growth and the dividends, the capital appreciation, what you take out is all completely tax-free. You compare that to a SIPP, right, or a Roth IRA in America or similar in Australia. When you're putting money in your 20s or 30s, you don't know what the rules are going to be when you take it out in your 50s and 60s. And a really good example of this is the changes to capital gains and inheritance on inherited pensions. And so after April, it's going to be the case that a lot of people, you could have a £2 million pension pot that you were able to give to your children effectively tax free, that can now be taxed up to 70%. Versus the ISA obviously is subject to inheritance tax rules. But when you have it, you know that you're relatively safe. I think that's what it feels. It feels that it's money the government, it would be scared to touch. Whether that will remain the case, I don't know. But that's my general thoughts. What about you, Phil?
Yeah, I agree completely. I think it's great that they're not slashing the limit would have been a big issue. 20,000 people like that. It's a safe haven for knowing that they can take any profits, they can get the interest on it, whether that be in a cash ISA. And as you say, people do have the money to put in, and it's a way of creating these millionaires without being taxed. So long live the ISA, I think.
Long live
Yeah.
the ISA, yeah.
But your pension being added to your inheritance tax situation
It's a
a
cash grab.
serious
What I think.
blow to pensions, and I don't understand why they don't like it. I mean, why would you do a pension now?
Well, I think that
It's almost.
the bigger issue that you have, when you speak to any independent financial advisor, is that the advice for the past 20, 30, 40, 20, 30 years, whenever the ISA was created, is run down your ISA and then run down your pension, because you'll be able to pass when you die, what's left in your pension can go to your children. And now
That's
that
true.
advice being completely blown out of the water, really, you
Yeah.
should be burning through your pension as quickly as possible because of the tax implications. And I do understand that we need to tax death more to, repair inequality in society. This is not the way to do it, because the big issue that you have, you're already struggling. The UK people do not invest, do not save enough for their pensions already. When you change the rules every 5 minutes, I mean, like, it was only a year ago that the max you could put in a pension a year was 40,000, and they increased it to 60,000 and scrap a lifetime allowance. You change these rules every 5 minutes, and it's virtually impossible to plan, which is why the ISA is so popular, because yes, the limit has changed over time, but you know that the money you have in your ISA is accessible at any time and is tax-free. That is a benefit that, the government, the thing is, Rachel Reeves is going to run out of options soon, so I suspect she'll go after them at some point, but I'm really hoping that she decides not to.
BYD, gents, BYD. I don't know if you saw the news this week, but basically their shares hit an all-time high, record high on the Hong Kong listing. They climbed 4.1% to HK$408 on Tuesday. Do you know why they've done that? Have you seen the news around this new technologies that they've got?
Well, the tech is obviously very impressive, but also, I mean, arguably it's Tesla dying as well on the other side. They're just still their market share.
So basically, BYD, Build Your Dreams, the Chinese car manufacturer, unveiled this new Super E platform, which is a 1,000 kilowatt or 1 megawatt charging system that promises to juice up their electric vehicles for 400 kilometers, which is about 249 miles, in just 5 minutes. I mean, that's roughly 2 kilometers of range per second faster, fast enough to rival the time it takes to almost fill a gas tank if you sit there, at the pump for a while. So that has been an absolute game changer. The superchargers max out around 500 kilowatts, so it's doubled the speed. And the company's founder, Wang Chuanfu, showcased the technology at an event in Shenzhen, announcing that the two new BYD models will roll out with this capability next month. So the Chinese really smashing things down, smashing Tesla. And as you say, this comes at a time when Tesla stumbles. I mean, stocks dropped 5% on the same day amid sale woes and brand challenges. We've seen Tesla dealerships in the US being targeted. I don't know if you've seen being firebombed. I mean,
Yeah.
it's
I mean, they've also been accused of fraud. I mean, even though you have, like, the president, various other politicians kind of trying to protect the company. I think the thing is, with this Chinese innovation with BYD, there's two issues here. The first is that While China is trying to change, the vast majority of these cars, the electricity is going to come from burning lignite coal. So it's not
Yeah.
particularly green. And the other thing is, yes, range is an issue and charging time is an issue with EVs, but the biggest issue is long-term battery life, right? You know, like how you have a phone, you have to replace it every 4 years because the battery just dies. It's the same with an EV. Most EV batteries will live only sort of 10 or 12 years. My suspicion is with the BYD technology, generally the faster a battery can charge, the less long its,
Faster it
overall
declines, yeah,
life is.
absolutely, yeah, exactly.
So, what happens, okay, so sure, you can charge and it's great, but you'll probably still get the same asset appreciation on the EVs because the charge of the charging, I mean, if you look in the UK, I mean, it's starting to come out now, but the vast majority of electric cars are bought by limited company directors for the tax benefits, right? Which are still extraordinarily good, even though they've been watered down recently. But then also Motability. And, regardless, I'm not making a comment on, Motability or its suitableness, but when one in five, new cars made in the UK is a Motability car, and then the majority of the rest of these are limited company director. How much of the free market is actually buying an electric car in the UK? Not very
I
much.
think you've nailed that, but I think the EV tide for company directors is changing because would you want to buy I don't know an average or a £60,000 EV and then find out it's worth 20,000 in 2 years just for the sake of tax savings? I mean the asset is becoming almost it's worth a third of
It
its value.
depends on your, yeah, sort of yes and no, but then the problem, I mean, we're all limited company directors, right? Like, by the time you've paid VAT, corporation tax, and dividend tax, you're looking at a third of whatever invoice you sent out to a company. So there is still a huge tax saving. Obviously, you just lease for cars is the answer rather than buying them outright.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I agree. I think the depreciation of EVs is the biggest issue. And the other thing is obviously hydrogen might come and take over the, lithium space.
Think a lot of people are doing salary sacrifice now, as you say,
Yeah,
for EV
yeah.
because of the BIC and side of things. But
Yeah, of course.
the other thing, Charles, while you're on, is interest rates. Obviously, we saw a decision with a vote for the England's Monetary Policy Committee voted 8-1 to hold the UK interest rates at 4.5%, citing economic uncertainty from the US President Trump's tariff policies and mixed domestic signals, including a 0.1% economic contraction in January and inflation expected to rise to 3% before easing. Governor Andrew Bailey signalled a cautious stance, balancing persistent wage growth and higher energy prices against a long-term goal of gradual rate cuts, possibly starting in May, as inflation remains above the 2% target and upcoming tax hikes looms. So what do you make of that? I mean, was this expected?
I think that the basic thing is you need to re retain pound parity against the US dollar and various international currencies. You can get more dollars now. I think it's $1.30 to the pound now. So if you're planning on going on holiday to America at any point, you've got quite strong currency. In terms of the interest rate decision, I think that decision was broadly expected based on the information we have available. The more interesting question is how far do they want to cut interest rates over the longer term? Again, you have to have parity against other currencies, but we have a massive debt pile in the UK, as do most Western countries, that we didn't have before. I mean, it's hugely risen over the past couple of decades. So having higher interest rates isn't sustainable if you also want to have public services. So you have to get them down a bit. I think one of the other really key things in America, the inflation rate target is 2 to 3%. In Australia, it's the same. In the UK, it's 2%. So what happens is we tend to restrict growth in order to keep our inflation lower. But I wonder whether the balance is incorrect because not America has grown massively because they've been a little bit less stressed about the inflation. I think we'll probably get a rate cut or two this year, but I don't see it going below 3.5% anytime soon.
Very good. Anything else you want to talk about in terms of standout RNSs or movers of the week, Charles? Because I know you mentioned at the beginning Sovereign there. What happened there this week?
I think basically that, I mean, they went on to a record high, both down under in the ASX and also on AIM. I think now that most of the potential problems with the Rio Tinto buyout are gone, and I suspect we're going to get a bid at some point in the next sort of 6 to 9 months, and potentially sooner. And so basically, I mean, it's the same as it always is, right? Which is when a share price is at a record high, people are a little bit scared to buy in case it drops back. But at the same time, the opportunity is immense, and they deserve the record. And it'll probably keep going. I suspect it'll keep going high.
Very good. Anything else you want to mention? I've been watching one program I want to talk about this week. I mean, it's pretty much in the news as well because of how hard hitting it was. It was Adolescence, which is a Netflix miniseries that premiered on March the 13th. It's been making waves, as I said. This British crime drama created by Jack Thorne and Stephen Graham follows the intense story of a 13-year-old Jamie Miller accused of murdering a classmate. Each of the four episodes is filmed in a single real-time shot, adding to the gripping and immersive feel. I mean, it's getting massive critical appraise. Viewers, I think Rotten Tomatoes was a 98% rating, which is your kind of your go-to one. Stephen Graham, the Scouser, great actor. He's brilliant. And the young lad, this Owen Cooper makes his kind of acting debut. But I think the one thing that stands out about the way it's shot is this single shot. I've never seen a series that's filmed literally in one take, from, you know, following them down corridors in and out, even to the point where at end of one episode they go from a standing in a street up into like almost like drone footage, like the camera's been taken up on a drone over there. So I'd you know, urge viewers and listeners to watch that if you get the chance. It addresses a lot of things, you know, masculinity, toxic masculinity, misogyny, social pressures, adolescence, and all sorts of things. So a great series.
Bit depressing though. I'll give you a warning.
It's depressing. I mean, there are some scenes in it that are a little bit upsetting, but I think I think if you showed this sort of content in secondary schools up and down the country, it would address, I'm not saying it would fix them overnight, but it would certainly, it looks at social media, like there's a whole debate. Do you think kids of 11, 12, 13 should have social media? Because I think it's...
Well, I'll tell you, Phil, my son is 11, nearly 12, and he doesn't have a smartphone. I think he's the only one in his class who doesn't.
Yeah.
I think having a smartphone is obviously incredibly valuable as an adult, and as kind of like mid-teens as well. I you know, he'll definitely have one when he's, you know, 13, 14. It's tricky because you don't want it to be ostracized. But on the other hand, I don't see what value an 11-year-old can have from owning a smartphone when the internet, you know, he has a computer, he has a laptop, we've got a smart TV. I mean, what does he need it for? The answer is, you know, social media, and I think it's a cancer for children's brains. Even as an adult, you know, we're on Twitter a lot, obviously, and LinkedIn and various other things. You can go down a very bad rabbit hole if you're not careful. As an adult, you know how to avoid it. As a child, you just don't. And you can't always police him, and therefore he's not having a device until he's a bit older. What do you think?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's terrible for the kids. Absolutely terrible. I mean, our kids have iPads, but the iPad is restricted. You know, they can only watch it normally at the weekends, actually. And even the TV, which is smart TV, as you say. So basically that means going on YouTube or whatever. Our kids do not watch traditional TV anymore.
It's the stuff like the social apps, like the TikToks, the Snapchats.
Yeah. No, they're not members of anything, and they're not going to be. But I mean, mine are only 7 and 9, but you know, we've already set the rules that they will get a phone when they're 14 years old. You know, and it's sort of good to say it now when the age they are, so they know the expectations. But even then, yeah, social media, I mean, it is a cancer. It destroys people. I mean, we are all on social media, and we can't cope with it in a lot of cases. Whether you like it or not, your brain is doing the comparison situation. Your brain is seeing things that you shouldn't see. You know, it's just a reality that we are. Our brains are bombarded by way more information than we could ever possibly expect to come to us, and it's not healthy.
Well, I think one of the like most interesting facets is that the world as a whole is more peaceful now than any time in history. And yet, if you were to look at social media and the news, you would think it's the opposite. And it's not. By and large, the world is very peaceful. And there's flare-ups, obviously, you know, in the DRC at the moment, or between Russia and Ukraine, or, you know, in the Middle East. But actually, the vast majority of the world, in terms of, like, country-to-country conflict, is relatively, you know, very safe compared to historically.
It's just you're constant bombarded with it.
It's a constant bombardment. But it's also, you know, like say, I don't know, let's say China invaded Taiwan, right? in the 21st century, we would all know within the next 60 seconds from the first rocket, right? Go back 150 years, you'd have to wait 3 weeks for the mail boat, you know? So you kind of like, you have this constant sort of constant need. I mean, the other negative aspect of it, obviously, is that you have the constant, you feel the constant need to be online all the time and reachable all the time, which is not the case. You don't need to be. Once you learn that, then
digital detox is a great thing for people to do, isn't it? You know,
and the one I thing have a 24/7 Telegram group, so maybe I'm not the best to talk about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, probably not very well versed to talk about that, but yeah. Okay, well, on that note, I think we've had a you know great guests on this week. It's always really great to interview the likes of Sean Day and Oliver Friesen. And you know, if you like what you've heard, please do subscribe, hit the bell icon so you get any notifications of further episodes, and have a great weekend all.
This podcast was brought to you by Roast PR Limited. If you would like to appear on a future episode of The Sunday Roast, please email admin@thesundayroast.net.